Where did all this dust come from? I squint, trying to see through it. I can still hear the noise and chaos from the onlookers. Someone must have set off a dust bomb. Then there's a voice telling me to get up. When I look to my side, I see a boy holding out his hand to me. He has bright blue eyes, dirt on his face, and a beat-up old cap on. And at this moment, I think he might be the most beautiful boy I've ever seen. Come on, he urges. I take his hand. In the dust and chaos, we hurry down the street and disappear into the afternoon's lengthening shadows.
Day. She won't tell me her name. I can understand that well enough. Lots of kids on the streets of Lake try to keep their identities a secret, especially after participating in something illegal like a skiz fight. Besides, I don't want to know her name. I'm still upset about losing the bet. Kaede's defeat cost me 1,000 notes. That was money toward a vial of cure. Time is running out and it's all this girl's fault. Stupid me. If she hadn't been responsible for getting Tess out of the ring, I would have left her to fend for herself. But I know Tess would have given me sad puppy eyes for the rest of the day, so I didn't. Tess continues to ask questions as she helps the girl, that's what I'll call her, I guess, clean the wound in her side as best as she can. I stay quiet for the most part. I'm on guard. After the skiz fight and my dust bomb, the three of us ended up camping out on the balcony of an old library. Does it still count as a balcony if the whole wall has collapsed and left this floor open to the air? In fact, almost all the floors have collapsed walls. The library is part of an ancient high-rise that now lies almost entirely in the water, several hundred feet from the lake's eastern edge, completely overgrown with wild grasses. It's a good place for people like us to find some shelter. I watch the streets along the banks for angry gamblers who might still be searching for the girl. I look over my shoulder from where I sit on the balcony's edge. The girl says something to Tess, and Tess smiles cautiously in return. My name's Tess, I hear her say. She knows better than to say mine, but she keeps on talking. What part of Lake are you from? Are you from another sector? She studies the girl's wound. That's a nasty one, but nothing that can't heal. I'll try to find some goat milk for you in the morning. It's good for you. Until then, you'll have to spit on it. It'll help with infections. I can tell from the girl's face that she knows this already. Thank you, she murmurs to Tess. She glances in my direction. I'm grateful for your help. Tess smiles again, but I can tell even she feels a little uncomfortable with this newcomer. I'm grateful for yours. I tighten my jaw. Night will fall in about an hour or so, and I have a wounded stranger added to my duties. After a while, I rise and join Tess and the girl. Somewhere in the distance, the Republic's pledge has started blaring from the city speakers. We'll stay here for the night. I look at the girl. How are you feeling? Okay, she replies, but it's obvious she's in pain. She doesn't know what to do with her hands, so she keeps reaching for her wound, then stopping herself. I have a sudden urge to comfort her. Why did you save me? She asks. I snort. No gaudy clue. You cost me 1,000 notes. The girl smiles for the first time, but there's something eternally cautious about her eyes. She seems to take in and analyze my every word. She doesn't trust me. You bet big, don't you? Sorry about that. She made me angry. She shifts. I'm guessing Kaede was no friend of yours. She's a bartender from the Rim of Alta in winter. Just a recent acquaintance. Tess laughs and gives me a look that I can't quite read. He likes to be acquainted with cute girls. I scowl at her. Bite your tongue, cousin. Haven't you had enough brushes with death for one day? Tess nods. A small smile on her face. I'll go get us some water. She jumps up and heads down the open stairwell to the water's edge. When she's gone, I sit down next to the girl, and my hand accidentally brushes past her waist. She takes a small breath. I move away, afraid that I've hurt her. That should heal soon, if it doesn't get infected. But you might want to rest a couple days. You can stay with us. The girl shrugs. Thanks. When I feel better, I'm tracking Kaede down. I lean back and study the girl's face. She's a little paler than other girls I see in the sector, and has large, dark eyes that shine with flecks of gold in the waning light. I can't tell what she is, which isn't unusual around here. Native, maybe, or Caucasian, or something. She's pretty in a way that distracts me, just like she did in the Skiz Ring. No, pretty's not the right word. Beautiful. And not only that, but she reminds me of someone. Maybe it's the expression in her eyes, something at once coolly logical and fiercely defiant. I feel my cheeks growing warm and suddenly look away, glad for the coming darkness. Maybe I shouldn't have helped her. Way too distracting. At this moment, all I'm thinking about is what I'd give up for the chance to kiss her, or to run my fingers through her dark hair. So, girl, I say after a while, thanks for your help today. For Tess, I mean. Where do you learn to fight like that? You broke Kaede's arm without even trying. The girl hesitates. From the corner of my eye, I can see her watching me. I turn to face her, and she pretends to study the water instead, as if embarrassed to be caught looking. She absently touches her side and then makes a clicking sound with her tongue as if out of habit. I hang around the edge of Batala a lot. I like to watch the cadets practice. Wow, you're a risk-taker, but your fighting is pretty impressive. I bet you don't have much trouble on your own. The girl laughs. You can see how well I did on my own today. She shakes her head. Her long ponytail swings behind. I shouldn't have watched the Skiz fight at all, but what can I say? Your friend looked like she could use some help. Then she shifts her gaze to me. That cautious expression still blankets her eyes. What about you? Were you in the crowd? No. Tess was down there because she likes seeing the action and she's a little nearsighted. I like watching from a distance. Tess, is she your younger sister? I hesitate. Yeah, close enough. It was really Tess I wanted to keep safe with my dust bomb, you know? The girl raises an eyebrow at me. I watch her lips as they curl into a smile. You're so kind, she says. And does everyone around here know how to make a dust bomb? I wave my hand dismissively. Oh sure, even kids. It's easy. I look at her. You're not from the Lake Sector, are you? The girl shakes her head. Tanegashi Sector. I mean, I used to live there. Tanegashi is pretty far away. You came all this way to see a Skiz fight? Of course not. The girl leans back and carefully lies down. I can see the center of her bandage turning a dark red. I scavenge on the streets. I end up traveling a lot. Lake isn't safe right now, I say. A splash of turquoise in the corner of the balcony catches my eye. There's a small patch of sea daisies growing from a crack in the floor. Mom's favorite. You might catch the plague down here. The girl smiles at me, as if she knows something I don't. I wish I could figure out who she reminds me of. Don't worry, she says. I'm a careful girl. When I'm not angry. When evening finally comes and the girl has dozed off into a fitful sleep, I ask Tess to stay with her so I can sneak away to check on my family. Tess is happy to do it. Going to the plague-infected areas of Lake makes her nervous, and she always comes back scratching at her arms, as if she can feel an infection spreading on her skin. I tuck a handful of sea daisies into the sleeve of my shirt and a couple of notes into my pocket for good measure. Tess helps me wrap both of my hands in cloth before I go to avoid leaving fingerprints anywhere. The night feels surprisingly cool. No plague patrols wander the streets, and the only sounds come from occasional cars and the distant blare of Jumbotron ads. The strange X on our door is still there, as prominent as ever. In fact, I'm almost certain that the soldiers have been back at least once, because the X is bright and the paint's fresh. They must have run a second check through the area. Whatever made them mark our door in the first place has apparently stuck around. I wait in the shadows near my mother's house, close enough so I can actually peek through the gaps of our backyard's rickety fence. When I'm sure that no one is patrolling the street, I dart through the shadows toward the house and crawl to a broken board that leads under the porch. I slide the board aside, then I crawl into the dark, stale-smelling crevice and pull the board back into place behind me. Small slivers of light come from between the floorboards in the rooms above me. I can hear my mother's voice toward the back, where our one bedroom is. I make my way over there, then crouch beside the bedroom's vent and look in. John is sitting on the edge of the bed with his arms crossed. His posture tells me that he's exhausted. His shoes are caked with dirt. I know Mom must have scolded him about that. John is looking toward the other side of the bedroom, where Mom must be standing, I hear her voice again, this time loud enough to understand. "Neither of us is sick yet," she says. John looks away and back toward the bed. "It doesn't seem to be contagious, and Eden's skin still looks good. No bleeding."
"Not yet," John replies. "We have to brace ourselves for the worst, Mom, in case Eden..."
Mom's voice is firm. "I won't have you saying that in my house, John."
"He needs more than suppressants. Whoever gave them to us is very kind, but it's not enough."
John shakes his head and gets up. "Even now, especially now, he has to protect my mother from the truth of my whereabouts." When he moves away from the bed, I can see that Eden is lying there with a blanket pulled up to his chin, despite the heat. His skin looks oily with sweat. The color of it is strange, too, a pale, sickly green. I don't remember other plagues with symptoms like that. A lump rises in my throat. The bedroom looks exactly the same, the few things in it old and worn, but still comfortable. There's the tattered mattress Eden's on, and next to it is the scratched-up chest of drawers that I used to doodle on. There's our obligatory portrait of the Elector hanging on the wall, surrounded by a handful of our own photos, as if he were a member of our family. That's all our bedroom has. When Eden was a toddler, John and I used to hold his hands and help him walk from one end of this room to the other. John would give him high fives whenever he did it on his own. Now I see Mom's shadow stop in the middle of the room. She doesn't say anything. I imagine her hunched shoulders, her head in her hands, her brave face finally gone. John sighs. Footsteps echo above me, and I know he must have crossed the room to hug her.
"Eden will be okay. Maybe this virus is less dangerous and he'll recover on his own."
There's a pause. I'm going to see what we have for soup. I hear him leave the bedroom. I'm sure John hated working at the steam plant, but at least he got to leave the house and take his mind off things for a while. Now he's trapped here, with no way to help Eden. It must be killing him. I clench the loose dirt under me and make as tight a fist as I can. If only the hospital had cures. Moments later, I see Mom walk across the room and sit at the edge of Eden's bed. Her hands are all bandaged up again. She murmurs something comforting to him and leans over to brush his hair from his face. I close my eyes. In my mind, I conjure up a memory of her face, soft and beautiful and concerned, her eyes bright blue and her mouth rosy and smiling. My mother used to tuck me in, smoothing down my blankets and whispering a promise of good dreams. I wonder what she's whispering to Eden now. Suddenly I'm overwhelmed with missing her. I want to rush out from under here and knock on our door. I push my fists harder into the dirt. No, the risk is too great. I'll find a way to save you, Eden. I promise. I curse myself for risking so much money in a skiz bet instead of finding a more reliable way to get cash. I pull out the sea daisies that I had tucked into my shirt sleeve. Some of the blossoms are crumpled now, but I prop them up as carefully as I can and gently pat down dirt around them. Mom will probably never see them here, but I know they're here. The flowers are proof to myself that I'm still alive, still watching over them. Something red in the dirt beside the daisies catches my eye. I frown, then brush aside more of the dirt to get a better look. There's a symbol here. Something inscribed underneath all the dirt and pebbles. It's a number, just like Tess and I had seen by the bank of the lake, except this time it says 2544. I used to hide down here sometimes when I was younger, back when my brothers and I would play hide and seek. But I don't remember seeing this before. I lean down and put my ear against the ground. At first there's nothing. Then I hear a faint sound, a whoosh, then a hissing and gurgling. Like some sort of liquid or steam. There's probably a whole system of pipes down there, something that leads all the way out to the lake, maybe all around the sector. I brush aside more dirt, but no other symbols or words appear. The number looks faded with age, the paint chipped away in little flakes. I stay there for a while, quietly studying it. I glance one last time through the vent at the bedroom, then make my way out from under the porch, into the shadows, and away into the city.
June. I wake up at dawn. The light makes me squint. Where is it coming from? Behind me? And for an instant, I'm disoriented, unsure of why I'm sleeping in an abandoned building, facing the ocean with sea daisies growing at my feet. A sharp pain in my stomach forces a gasp out of me. I've been stabbed, I realize in a panic. And then I remember the skiz fight, and the knife, and the boy who saved me. Tess hurries over when she sees me stir. How are you feeling? She still looks wary of me. Sore, I mutter. I don't want her to think that she wrapped my wound badly, so I add, much better than yesterday, though. It takes me a minute to realize that the boy who had saved me is sitting in the corner of the room, dangling his legs over the balcony and looking out toward the water. I have to hide my embarrassment. On a normal day, with no knife wound, I never would have let a detail like that go unnoticed. He went somewhere last night. When I was slipping in and out of sleep, I'd made a mental note of the direction he took, south, towards Union Station.
I hope you don't mind waiting a few hours before eating, he says to me.
He's wearing his old newsboy cap, but I can see a few strands of white blonde hair beneath it.
We lost the skiz bet, so there's no money left for food right now.
He blames me for his loss. I just nod. I recall the sound of Day's crackly voice from the speakers and compare it quietly to this boy's. He looks at me for a while without smiling, as if he knows what I'm doing, then returns to his vigil. No, I can't be sure the voice belongs to him. Thousands of people in Lake could match that voice. I realize that the mouthpiece in my cheek is still turned off. Thomas must be furious with me. Tess, I say, I'm going to head down to the water. I'll be back in a minute. You sure you can make it by yourself? She asks. I'll be fine, I smile. If you see me floating unconscious out to sea, though, by all means come and get me. The steps of this building definitely used to be part of a stairwell, but now they sit open to the outside. I get to my feet and limp down the stairs one at a time, careful not to slip off the side and plummet down to the water. Whatever Tess did last night seems to be working. Although my side still burns, the pain is a little duller, and I can walk with less effort than yesterday. I make it down to the bottom of the building faster than I thought I would. Tess reminds me of Mateus, of how he'd nurse me back to health on the day of his induction. But I can't handle memories of Mateus right now. I clear my throat and concentrate on making my way to the water's edge. The rising eastern sun is now high enough to bathe the entire lake in a shade of murky gold, and I can see the tiny strip of land that separates the lake from the Pacific Ocean. I head all the way down to the floor of the building that sits right at the water's surface. Every wall on this floor is collapsed, so I can walk straight out to the building's edge and ease my legs into the water. When I look into the depths, I can see that this old library continues for many floors, perhaps 15 stories tall, judging from how the buildings on the shore sit and how the land slopes from the shoreline. Approximately 6 stories should be underwater. Tess and the boy sit at the top of the building, several stories above me, safely out of hearing range. I look back at the horizon, click my tongue, and turn on my microphone. Static buzzes from my earpiece. A second later, I hear a familiar voice. Ms. Paris, Thomas says. Is that you? I'm here, I murmur. I'm well. I'd like to know what you've been up to, Ms. Paris. I've been trying to contact you for the past 24 hours. I was ready to send some soldiers to collect you, and you and I both know how happy Commander Jameson would be about that. I'm well, I say again. My hand digs into my pocket and pulls out Day's pendant. Got a minor injury in a skiz fight. Nothing serious. I hear a sigh from the other end. Well, you're not going to go that long again with your mic off, you hear me? He says. Fine. Did you find anything yet? I glance up to where the boy is swinging his legs. Not sure.
A boy and girl helped me get out of the skiz chaos. The girl bandaged up my wound. I'm staying with them temporarily until I can walk better.
Walk better? Thomas's voice rises. What kind of minor injury is this?
Just a knife wound, no big deal.
Thomas makes a choking sound, but I ignore it and keep going.
Anyway, that's not the point. The boy made a fancy little dust bomb to get us out of the skiz mob. He has some skills. I don't know who he is, but I'll get more information.
Think he's Day? Thomas asks. Day doesn't seem like the kind of boy who goes around saving people.
Most of Day's past crimes involve saving people, all except Mateus.
I take a deep breath.
No, I don't think so. I lower my voice until it's barely a whisper. Best not to throw wild guesses at Thomas right now, lest he decide to jump the gun and send troops after me. Commander Jameson will boot me right off her patrol if we do something expensive like that, with nothing to show for it. Besides, these two got me out of serious trouble.
But they might know something about Day.
Thomas is silent for a moment. I hear some commotion in the background, some static, and then his faint voice, along with Commander Jameson's. He must be telling her about my injury, asking her if it's safe to keep me out here alone. I give an annoyed sigh, as if I've never been wounded before. After a few minutes, he comes back on again.
Well, be careful.
Thomas pauses for a moment.
Commander Jameson says to keep you on your mission if your injury isn't bothering you too much. She's preoccupied with the patrol right now. But I'm warning you, if your mic goes dark again for more than a few hours, I'm going to send soldiers after you. Whether or not it blows your cover. Understand?
I fight to contain my irritation. Commander Jameson doesn't believe I can accomplish anything on this mission. Her lack of interest is imprinted in every word of Thomas's response. As for Thomas, he rarely sounds so firm with me. I can only imagine how stressed out he must have been over the last few hours.
Yes, sir, I say.
When Thomas doesn't respond, I look up toward the boy again. I remind myself to watch him more closely when I get upstairs, and not let this injury distract me. I stuff the pendant back into my pocket and rise. I observe my rescuer all day as I follow him around the Alta sector of Los Angeles. I take note of everything, no matter how small the detail. He favors his left leg, for instance. The limp is so slight that I can't tell when he's walking beside Tess and me. I see it when he sits down or gets up, the slightest hesitation when he bends his knee. It's either a serious injury that never quite healed, or a minor but recent one. A bad fall, maybe. That's not his only injury. Now and then he winces when he moves his arm. After he does this a couple times, I realize that he must have had some sort of wound on his upper arm that stretches painfully whenever he reaches too far up or down. His face is perfectly symmetrical, a mix of Anglo and Asian, beautiful behind the dirt and smudges.